the 4th of April 1983 went down in British criminal history when a gang of armed robbers raided a high security depot in London nicknamed Fort Knox.
At the time, it was the biggest cash robbery in this country.
This team were obviously regarded as being in the top echelon of robbers.
The heist was executed with military precision. The robbers carefully planned their attack and fled without a trace.
It seemed to be completely devoid of any clues. They just seemed to have vanished with the money.
They held the guards captive for an agonizing 8 hours and then stole almost £7 million. But how did they do it? This is the unbelievable story of the Security Express heist. Easter Monday, April 1983. Security supervisor Greg Council was starting his early morning shift at the Security Express depot in Shoreditch, London.
Greg Council was the controller for the day, and he came in to work very early, took over from the other controller. His job was to allow people to come in into the secure part of the building, and generally he would sit there monitoring the cameras.
It was no normal day at the office. The bank holiday meant the depot was awash with cash as they waited for the banks to reopen the following day. Greg waited for the other guards to arrive before allocating the workload.
And it was on Easter Monday. There was a big prize there because of the Daily Mail exhibition at Earl's Court. That would bring in a lot of money every year.
So millions of pounds had to be handled that day. Each guard would be busy. As Greg waited for the first of the seven men to arrive, he went about his usual routine.
At one stage, he got up to go and get the pint of milk that was just outside the back door near a place where the wheelie bins were stored.
It was a routine move that Greg did on most shifts, but it was about to change his life forever.
One of the guards used to come out of the morning to get his cuppa and go to the other control box where they had a trap in the wall. The milkman used to leave the bottles of milk. But in doing so, he had to come out of the main building and switch all the security off and all the sensors. So there was the chink in the armour.
He just opened the back door, stretch out to get the pint of milk, and he was then pounced on by six people, all balaclavaed up.
Greg had no time to react. A gang of armed robbers pounced on him. He was led back into the depot at gunpoint and now feared for his life.
He was then taken back to the control room where he was held for hours.
The security supervisor was ordered to sit back at his station and remain calm. He was still the only man on duty, but unbeknown to him, the armed gang had a detailed plan.
He was actually put by his desk, but two of the robbers hid themselves underneath his desk with a shotgun aimed at his crutch piece. And that's where he sat for a long while, letting his fellow colleagues come in one by one.
The pressure on Greg was immense. Seven other men were due on duty, and he knew that it took more than one guard to access the millions of pounds stored in the vaults. But so too did the robbers.
You got to get the guards to tell you what's what and what you open first or second or third or fourth, what keys you put in, which way you turn them, panic buttons and alarm buttons.
And it appeared that the robbers even knew detailed knowledge of the premises, the security cautions they take, the locks, the keys.
He did a good job in a way, because he was told not to look up and not see any faces, because if someone comes in the main entrance and they get a look, there was nothing to stop them running back out the door and raising the alarm. So that was a crucial moment. Everyone who walked through that door, which had to be monitored really exclusively. And poor old Greg had a shooter up his Niagara's, so he had to do as he's told, didn't he, you know?
Really, what made it even more devastating was the fact that they were there so long. Security guards were coming in every half an hour. They were confronted by a shotgun. They were then put at the back, and it just seemed impossible that no one had noticed something untoward going on.
So the pressure was on. Guard after guard arrived for their shift, with Greg dutifully letting them in. The hours ticked by, and the phones rang as usual. But remarkably, Greg managed to keep it together, despite being held at gunpoint.
Who's that?
It's my wife.
And they've all laid down, they was all looked after. It was lunchtime, wasn't it? So that's been a long morning, you know, and their phones never stopped ringing.
Bye-bye.
The firm must have known that the time was running out.
The robbers laid in wait for over 7 hours, working with military precision. Each guard now lay helpless in the locker room. All but one man was accounted for, and he held the vital information they were after.
Jamie Alcott was the custodian with the keys. He had to take over the keys and know what to do with them, how to put the keys into the locks, and things like that.
But the last guard wasn't about to give up his information easily.
And one was the stubborn old boy who was being a bit clever. Of course, they had a little can of a lighter fluid. And he's told to behave himself, otherwise he's going to be set alight if he didn't tell the truth.
A gang of 6 armed robbers had burst into a security express depot in London, ready to steal millions of pounds. But it wasn't nicknamed Fort Knox for nothing. They controlled the building, but had to force every guard in there to cooperate in order to reach the money. And the last guard was going to be their biggest hurdle.
The robbers particularly wanted Jamie Alcock to come into the premises, although they had to wait for all the personnel to come in because they couldn't allow anyone to come in after they'd started removing the cash. But Alcock was the one they wanted because I think they had the information that he was the second key holder for that day. So therefore, they needed him to be there to give them the combination of the keys.
If he didn't tell the truth about where the keys were, the whole business is blown. It was a very touchy situation.
Time was running out. The robbers had been waiting for over 7 hours for the final guard to clock on. He was the only one who knew the whereabouts of the vault keys.
When they first asked Jamie Alcock to produce the second set of keys to open the vaults, he originally gave them a blank. It's not me, it's not me. And then the robbers got a little bit terse with him, and it then turned to extreme violent behaviour.
By this time, the gang was wound up. They had spent months crafting their plan. Now one man was standing in their way.
So they got a can of petrol and started to pour it over him, and somebody produced a box of matches, threatening to set him alight.
He knew where they were, and he wouldn't say where they were, so that's why he had the treatment with the lighter fuel, you know. But he wasn't harmed, he wasn't hurt.
Well, of course, Mr. Alcock had no option then but to get the second set of keys, and at that particular stage, it was getting rather nasty.
Alcock was now badly shaken. He had been doused in petrol and terrorised. Although unharmed, he realised the robbers meant business. He had to cooperate. The gang now had all the pieces of the jigsaw. They grabbed a different guard, Alan Grimes, to put the final part of the plan into action. Their aim was to penetrate the highly secure vault, which could only be opened by a combination of keys and codes. Once inside, sealed bags were held in cages, and a further seven safes housed even more money. But the thieves were running out of time.
They made him open up the vaults. I mean, it was security there was tremendous, but you had to have someone to do it, to open it up for him.
The pressure was now mounting. No vans had left the depot for over 8 hours. Phones were ringing off the hook with customers wondering where the guards were. All but one were bound and gagged in the depot. The robbers had limited time to get to the millions of pounds.
It's a long procession to get to the vaults themselves. Once they saw all those cages full up with plastic folders full of cash, you know, they're all, every cage is full up with money, and there was cage after cage of them. Between 6 and 7 million pounds was cleared out. All that was left was silver, I think, at the end.
The firm wasted no time loading the contents of the vault into their waiting van. Nearly 7 million pounds was removed in just 20 minutes.
Once you're in there, you're not going to run out and leave £200,000 or £300,000 in a bag. It's only a matter of throwing them on, isn't it? You've got to clear it out.
But as the van sped away, one gang member nearly blew their whole operation.
On the way out, one got nearly trapped in the door because the doors was closing on him, and he got stuck in just at the last moment. Because they had to run across the yard from the box, press the button and then run and get out. Of course, the vans and the car had already gone, the van with the money, and they're just the car outside waiting for him.
And then there was silence. The guards were left bound and gagged. Millions of pounds had been stolen whilst they lay there helpless. And the police had no idea until one of the guards struggled free and raised the alarm.
When I actually got to the premises, there was at least 8 of the security staff. They were all in various places, being interviewed by officers. You could see various items, like stockings. The guards' helmets were left on the floor. And then when you went in the vaults, of course, there was turmoil there. The whole thing was just in chaos, really.
The highly organised gang wasted no time in fleeing to a secret location.
There's not many places you can drive a big vehicle in. There's too many nosy people around in town. It's got to be out in the sticks a little bit where you can pull down a few lanes and then pull into somewhere where you've got no neighbours.
Police were now in a race against time to draw up a list of potential suspects.
I think from the outset, we knew it was a real professional team and probably an old-fashioned team, a mature team. They seemed to be well in control of the guards. They knew exactly what to do and say and how to frighten the guards into doing what they were told.
So professional was the gang that they left no way of tracing them at the scene. By the time the police were looking for clues, the thieves were tallying up their new fortune.
I was invited on board to help. The money went back to a barn where the money was laid out on trestles and divided up into different sections and parcels. Everyone was in charge of their own particular money, you know. It's very nice, but you couldn't even put anything in your pocket and take it home with you, could you, you know? Or go home and say, go and go out and buy yourself a new car. You have to keep very quiet about it, don't you? Very stum.
With the money in hand, the gang asked Freddie Foreman, a prominent member of the London underworld, on board to help handle the vast amount of cash. Meanwhile, the investigation quickly grew into one of Scotland Yard's largest ever. They needed results, and officers were desperate for clues.
There was immense pressure to capture these people, so much so that I think most of the members of the flying squad, and I think there was 80-plus that were actually engaged on it right from the beginning. There was hardly anything left there at all. It seemed to be completely devoid of any clues. They just seemed to have vanished with the money.
And whilst officers were put on the back foot with no forensic leads at the depot, the cash was divided and taken deeper into the gang's network.
We were fortunate enough to have an office in the building where the money was kept. And had tea and sandwiches and counting machines and things. And of course, all marked money has to be disposed of if the bank staff have marked it in any particular way. So that can get you arrested and nicked later on, you know. So you have to go for it all, really, as best as you can.
As Foreman counted the cash, detectives started to pick up on other leads.
We were doing a bit of proactive policing, setting up surveillance points on various teams. One of the bits of information we had concerned a particular pub in Stoke Newington called the Albion. An informant had phoned us to say that people who were frequenting that were involved in the robbery. We had set up an observation point which lasted for months and months, and we did in fact see three or four people that were already in our system who had been put forward as potential suspects for the robbery.
The officers on the flying squad, they'd been there years. They knew the notable families in the East End or London, full stop, who would be capable of committing this type of robbery. We just put all the names in forward. We would go out and do work on them and come back and decide whether we actually went and did searches, arrested them, brought people in, did some interviews. But it was very difficult because the fact is that we had no evidence.
The flying squad were now on the trail of several suspects, but had little to go on other than their hunch. Meanwhile, Foreman was carefully making plans.
It's very difficult. I mean, if you've got a large amount of money, to leave it somewhere where you know it's going to be safe. I actually did have somewhere. I had a friend who was in the city, and he was in charge of an office block. It used to be a bank on the ground floor. So the basement still had the vaults and the safes, same as the Secure Express in a sense, you know. So the money went from one vault to another vault for safety, and that was it should have been left there, really, for indefinitely. It would have been a much better idea, I suppose.
The hunt for the missing millions was on. No forensic leads were coming from the depot. But how had the gang managed to break into the building?
I don't think any team of that quality would ever commit a robbery without detailed knowledge of the premises, the security cautions they take, the locks, the keys, and not many people apart from mid-management or higher would know all these details. There was absolutely no doubt in our minds that there was somebody very senior that had given this team inside information. And it appeared that the robbers even knew details of the families of these guards. So, you know, to know the whole outline, it appeared that there was somebody higher up than these guards.
But all inquiries on an inside man drew a blank. Months of surveillance on suspects were going cold with no new evidence. Meanwhile, Foreman was working hard not to change his lifestyle. Whilst his chunk of the money was stored safely, he went about his business as usual.
I was still living in the same flat. I had businesses, I had betting, I had casinos, I had pubs, clubs. I'm entitled to have a bit of cash. I could account for quite a lot of it. My intentions were to live in Spain and America. When I went to America, I was nearing up a dollar millionaire.
But detectives were digging deeper for clues, so Foreman worked hard not to arouse suspicion.
So I never changed my lifestyle at all in London. I still had the same car. I had an Audi, I think, at the time, and someone had run into the back of me. And it was all bented and doubled up, and I thought, no, I won't get it fixed. I'll leave it like it is, you know.
While Foreman was keeping his head down, officers were getting closer to some of the other suspects. And this was about to pay off. Detectives finally got the breakthrough they desperately needed.
There was a wall with screws, and as we took the top half of the wall away, turned it round, there was some writing on it, and what it was figures, starting with £400,000. Behind the wall was three canvas sacks, and they were full of money, full of notes.
An armed gang of robbers had ambushed a security express depot and fled with millions of pounds. The thieves had left no forensic clues, and all police knew was that this was the biggest cash robbery ever to hit the UK. But now, after months of drawing blanks, their surveillance was about to pay off.
The initial breakthrough was when a vehicle was found in the East End, in Hackney, I believe it was. As a result of that, we went back over what we'd done in Hackney, and it was very, very close to a garage proprietor who we'd looked at and had been visited by people who we eventually arrested.
It didn't happen right away. It happened some months later when some fella, never met him, didn't know him, a friend of John Knight's, I think it was. He was the one who sort of started the ball rolling.
The man in question was John Horsley, a garage owner who appeared to be well connected to the underworld.
I don't know exactly how it came about, but it wasn't anybody that I knew directly, you know, at the time.
His house was searched, and during the search of his house, he was found that he's financially, he wasn't very well off. In fact, he was in debt up to his eyeballs. Couldn't pay his gas, his electric. All of a sudden, he acquired a lot of money, paid his bills off, took his wife and family on holidays, all had cars, and were living a life for Ireland.
Police knew they were onto something. They put pressure on Horsley to explain his dramatic change in lifestyle.
Right from the outset, Horsley denied everything. But when officers were putting to him photographs, who he met, the days he met, the number of days he met people, the number of days he met these convicted robbers, it was then that he realised that the situation was very dire for him, and he more or less confessed everything.
He told us that his part of the robbery was that he'd been asked if there was anywhere he could give as a storage place. He offered his garage, which he owned, and the gentleman who asked him if he could have a storage place asked for both or all the keys that he had to the garage, and he said it would be well looked after for the use of the garage. He gave him two keys. The people went away. He then turned up when they asked him to help unload a van, which was full of very large canvas bags, which all went into Mr. Horsley's garage and was then locked, and away they went.
And the revelations weren't going to stop there. Horsley had snitched, but his further confessions were going to shock even the gang members.
Mr. Horsley, unfortunately, told a little lie. He still had one key. And that night he went back to the garage, went into it, opened some of his torn sacks and found they were all full of money. So in his own statement, he said he helped himself to a few thousand pounds and away he went.
With Horsley now freely giving information, detectives pushed to find the new whereabouts of the cash. Searches on his garage revealed it was long gone from there.
Mr. Horsley then decided to tell us that he'd been asked to look after one of the robbers' share of the money, to count it, look after it, put it in a safe place so that it was available when he needed money. What he told us was that his father-in-law was an old-age pensioner, and within his flat in a warden control place, he'd put a false wall that allegedly the father-in-law didn't know about, and behind that wall was three bags of money. So it was then that Mr. Wilton decided we would go out there and then and search his father-in-law's house. But we were told it would be money. We needed tolls and bags to get the money. Turned up, went into an old-age pensioner's flat. First thing we noticed was the pool table where Mr. Horsley said he'd counted the money on. And secondly, went into a room and there was a wall with screws freshly in it, which we undid. And as we took the top half of the wall away, turned it round, there was some writing on it, and what it was figures, starting with £400,000. And it was then like withdrawals that basically the gentleman who committed the robbery would take. Yeah. Behind the wall was three canvas sacks, and they were full of money, full of notes.
The interrogations didn't stop there. Horsley was a man at breaking point. But would he give up his all-important contacts?
Mr. Horsley, in his disclosure to us, had named the people who had turned up, or some of the people he knew. It was a massive breakthrough, and it was the start of the arrests of the main players within the robbery.
The police had their breakthrough. Horsley admitted his link with Billy Hickson, a local gangster with a string of convictions for robbery. And Terence Perkins, hard man from North London with one previous minor conviction. Both men were known to the police and potentially dangerous. But officers didn't stop there.
It was Mr. Perkins' money, which was behind the wall. The money was a large breakthrough because we had no evidence. We now have evidence of cash that came from that robber.
They now had one suspect definitely linked with the cash found. But the firm were about to discover they had another supergrass amongst them.
Horsley mentioned another man who was on the periphery, a man called Opiola. We didn't know hardly anything about Mr. Opiola, but he gave us a bit of a clue.
The flying squad was on the verge of another massive breakthrough. Mr. Alan Opiola was to prove the next big chink in the robber's armour. Detective Chief Inspector Wilson wasted no time in bringing him in for questioning.
Our inquiries reveal that Mr. Opiola ran a garage that was owned by John Knight. So the information gathered momentum within, 4 or 5 days, and when we arrested Mr. Opiola, similarly to Horsley, he was just a minnow, and within a couple of days of being shown the fact that he had rented this van, he succumbed, and he in fact became a supergrass. He told us so much that he became a very, very important witness.
Opiola's information revealed he'd been leaned on by his associate to help after the robbery.
And lo and behold, Mr. Opiola deposited £30,000 notes because he'd allowed his house to be used. He stated that his house had been used for 3 or 4 days to count the money from their bags, and it took them 3 or 4 days. His bedroom was used. His wife went and stayed with the mother-in-law.
Less than 24 hours after Opiola's revelations, flying squad officers turned up at the next suspect's house. John Knight, well known to the police and business partner of Opiola's. The informants had played right into the officers' hands. The police now had their men, but would the gang reveal all? The mystery of the largest cash robbery in London was about to be cracked by Scotland Yard. The flying squad had found nearly £400,000 of the missing millions, and their informants had revealed vital secrets. Now they had key suspects in their grasp, but would they give away any clues to the heist?
When we first arrested John Knight, at his home was found a list of building societies. During the next 24 hours, 48 hours, having visited all these branches, we realised that he'd been putting large amounts of cash into these building societies after the robbery.
They were arrested, the houses searched, certain items were found and brought in, and they were all interviewed. And from there, they were kept in custody. As a result of the evidence we then had.
Cracks were starting to show. The main suspects gave nothing away, but evidence was mounting. Foreman knew it was time to leave.
So I thought, well, the best thing is to get over to Spain and lay low and see how it develops and see what happens. That's what I did, that's when I left. But it was a bit ominous to leave on that particular day because that was obviously recorded and knew that I left on the day that Johnny Knight was arrested.
Despite the coincidence, Foreman jetted off to start a new life in Spain.
After 9 months out there, things seemed okay, and we felt pretty safe and secure. So I started lashing out a little bit and investing a little bit of money and on a few apartments, you know, which was used by family and friends most of the time.
And it didn't take long for officers to extend their search to foreign shores.
Right from the start, when these people were arrested, we realised that there were connections abroad, Spain, Portugal, Switzerland. We had evidence that they had accounts actually in Spain. Even while John Knight was in custody, there was efforts by him and his family to get a safe deposit box opened in Spain.
And I took off on several occasions and I did every town in Spain and every coastal town or the whole perimeter. I mean, just for it to die down, but as soon as you came back, it was still going strong. The press, once the press get their teeth in it.
Detectives never gave up the hunt. It wasn't long before they were on Foreman's heels.
Freddie Foreman was part of the second wave of this inquiry with Ronnie Knight, John Mason, Everett. Freddie, in fact, goes back many years when you think about the craze, Jack the Hat, Ginger Marks, people like that. He has been in the top line of criminals in London for many, many years. We had information during the first year of our inquiry to do with Freddie Foreman, but we were so involved in preparing a case against the people we'd arrested that we had to shelve a lot of the inquiries because we just didn't have the personnel to do it. We knew he was in Spain. Spain were feeding us information of what was going on over there.
It was during inquiries in Spain regarding one of the suspects that officers stumbled across a link to Foreman.
My name never came into the frame until 9 months later when I was in Spain, when the police came to the Alcazaba and asked questions about John Knight. So the manager there. He said, no, there's nobody by the name of John Knight. It's got an apartment here. So they got their papers together and put them back in their briefcase and got up to leave and got to the door. But Ronnie Knight, they said, he's got an apartment here. And his big friend, Freddie. Oh, I said, has he? And they came back and started the inquiry all over again.
Detectives may have got close to Foreman, but remarkably, it wasn't until 6 years later that a twist of fate brought them face to face. Little did Foreman know, British authorities had been working closely with the Spanish police to bring their suspect back to the UK.
As I was getting in the car, they pounced on me. They took me straight to Marbella police station. Then they banged me up downstairs in a cage with a load of smackheads and different Moroccans and different nationalities. I said, I want my lawyer over here to just send over for my lawyer, because nobody knew they had me. And next thing I knew, I was in the car, handcuffed, racing along the carretera 90 mile an hour. And I know where we're going, to the airport. We go straight on the tarmac. We don't go through the airport terminal. Go straight on to where the plane's waiting to taxi off. But it was empty. There was no one else on it. I broke away from them. And I went into the terminal over the barrier, and all the people were queuing up waiting to come on board. I thought the more I kicked off, the more commotion I caused, they wouldn't put me on the plane, you know? They got me up the flight of stairs, and I put my foot in the side of the staircase, and we all went down. Eventually, they got me onto the plane and threw me down. And one of the stewards, a fella, came over and said, "Sir, Mr. Foreman," he said, "it's very hot. You must be thirsty. Have a drink." And I lifted my head up. Yeah, that's right, that very kind of you. You know? And he had a beaker, and he tipped it up, and I'd swallowed it all down, and as soon as I swallowed it, I knew that, because there's a bitter taste. I felt myself being carried to one of the seats. They woke me up, actually woke me up, because I was still spark out, as I saw the robbery squad coming down the plane and arrested me.
Along with the previous suspects, police now had Foreman. But getting any new information would be hard. And he wasn't about to lead them to any of the cash.
If you've got anything on me, then you show me the evidence.
We recovered a lot of cash at a relative of Mr. Horsley, but in most cases, the robbers had bought property, put money in banks. So that is why we got several officers from the fraud squad to assist us, because it seemed more of a financial case than it was any other form of evidence. But of course, the thing that let the robbers down mostly was the fact that one minute they were penniless, and from April the 4th of 1983, they had vast amounts of money. So, you know, it just seemed so obvious that they were engaged in this particular robbery.
It was only 360,000 they traced that had been transferred from different banks from different places, and they could prove that. But I had businesses, so I could account for quite a lot of it.
The gang were on borrowed time. It had taken years, but Scotland Yard were finally piecing together their evidence through bank account details. But how the gang managed to infiltrate a top security depot remained a mystery until some time later.
Apparently, it wouldn't have happened without the office. The office across the alleyway at the side of the building was really the important reason why you could observe and spot this little chink in the armour, this floor. There's always a lot of involvement. There's a lot of work has to be done right the way through the night. Sleeping bags, flasks and binoculars and everything to get every little detail, you know, and the angle of the cameras and things like that. Where do you think is a blind spot?
Camera on each corner, mate.
It's not like in the movies when they come all dressed in black, like ninja turtle things, and they're throwing grappling hooks over the wall and scrambling up. I think they were all a bit too old for all that. So it's just a ladder up the wall and a ladder to go down the other side. And then it was all taken away in the van afterwards, apparently. I don't expect any one of the firm would have thought that they would have been there for over 12 hours on the robbery, because it started at 12 o'clock on the night, got to 3 o'clock when it was able to go over the wall when it was quiet, to hole up there and wait until the morning when the first guard came on duty.
After years of detective work, officers finally had evidence linking most of the suspects to the robbery.
The trial was regarded as very serious. The magnitude of the robbery and the robbers concerned were such that they were escorted to the court every single day of the trial. Two of the robbers got 22 years. That was John Knight and Terence Perkins. They were found guilty of the robbery. Billy Hickson actually was acquitted of the robbery and was sentenced to 6 years for handling stolen goods. James Knight was sentenced to 7 years imprisonment for handling a substantial sum of the cash. Ronnie Knight was in fact sentenced to 8 years when he surrendered and actually flew over here.
You're in mind guilty of the robbery of £6 million.
The two informants also received time for their part in the robbery. John Horsley was given 8 years and Alan Opiola 3, both for handling the money. As for Foreman, his trial was high profile and well publicised.
The prisoners were brought to the court under heavy escort every single day, and the jurors were in fact given police protection throughout the trial. That's how serious it was regarded, and that's how serious the gang involved were.
Well, I didn't expect to get guilty of anything. You finally get with handling, you know. 9 years. I had to serve 6 years of that, you know.
I think in all, five of six of the main robbers were sentenced to some term of imprisonment.
The hunt for the missing loot was over. Scotland Yard had managed to cage a number of top London gangsters, but how much of the £6.5 million was ever recovered?
We recovered certain amounts of cash, but the inquiry then was taken over by insurance companies, and they retrieved large amounts through the houses belonging to the robbers, houses they bought in Spain, Portugal, and other places. All in all, I believe that nearly £3 million was recovered.
It was one of the first cases of criminal bankruptcy where the insurance company then decided to go after the people who'd been convicted and seize their assets.
This was a robbery that shook London. It took the authorities over 7 years to recover less than half the cash. The whereabouts of the rest of the money remains a mystery. But despite the gang's planning and skill, most were brought to justice.
There is no doubt that the guards on that day had been put through sheer hell, because the fact that they had been held in the premises by these robbers for so long must have caused them great anxiety.
All the guards suffered trauma, but went on to recover from their ordeal over time. Despite initial suspicions, no Security Express employee has ever been linked with the robbery.
The gang were big, hard men, because they lived in an area where they had to be, and they were respected in that way by other villains. People would not mess with them because of their notoriety.
I did have sort of two lives. I had the respectable businessman with the pubs and the betting shops and the casino and the nightclubs. And then there was the other side, the darker side. The pressure on my family was immense. Long periods away from home, in prison, you know, it's a long time out of anybody's life. There's quite a number of things in life which I regret doing, definitely.
Foreman spent many years behind bars, but it hasn't changed his outlook on life.
I don't really feel guilty about anything I did. I felt justified in what I'd done. But it was all survival. It's survival of the fittest. It's a dog-eat-dog world, the criminal world. But, you know, that's life.